In this episode of Startups for the Rest of Us, I'm going to be talking to Jesse Meekham about the unconventional MVP. This is Startups for the Rest of Us, episode 252. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at launching software products. Whether you've built your first product or you're just thinking about it. I'm Mike.
I'm Jesse.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. How are you doing this week, Jesse?
I'm doing very well.
Excellent. Well, I wanted to have you on the show today because I wanted to talk to you a little bit about your story and share the background of your company with the listeners and talk a little bit about the MVP that you essentially put out in the market and the product that you started with. But kind of before we get to that point, I wanted to let people know exactly who you are and a little bit more about your business. The company that you started is called You Need a Budget. Yep. And when did you start this company?
Back in September of 2004.
Okay. And today you essentially sell personal budgeting software for, I believe it's $60 per license, correct?
It is. Yeah. It's still desktop software for the time being, $60 one time. And then we've sold upgrades over the years to kind of keep the revenue going.
Right. So you call the company You Need a Budget. It's kind of colloquially known as YNAB. Right. Where does YNAB stand today? Like, how big is the business? What's your approximate revenue look like? How often do you do software releases? And how many employees do you have? That kind of stuff.
Software releases, we haven't done one for a long time because we're right in the middle of a big, completely from scratch rewrite, moving to the web and changing our business model into a SaaS model. So that part has changed quite a bit. We've been just heads down on that for couple years. Size-wise, employees, I think we just hired our 30th or 31st. She starts next Tuesday. Her name's Carrie, and she'll be managing our customer support team. So pretty good sized team, a mix of part-time and full-time people. About two-thirds of them are full-time. We're engineer heavy and got a couple designers. We need another designer here pretty soon. But yeah, I always say we won't hire anymore and then we hire again. So, and then revenue wise, last year we did about $4.5 million, and this year we're looking to do maybe a smidgen more, but just around there again.
Right. So essentially 30 employees, $4.5 million in revenue, and this is a downloadable one-time purchase software.
Yeah, that's kind of funny. But yeah,
right.
Yeah, it is. I mean, just recently Intuit, who is our main competitor, they sell Quicken and QuickBooks and Mint, and you know they own all those properties. They just mentioned that they were going to sell off Quicken, which is a good signal for us that we're doing the right thing, getting out of the desktop software business as well. So,
right.
A little side.
Okay. So, as I said, I mean, I wanted to focus in on kind of the big picture first to give people an idea of why you're on the show, because I think that the backstory behind YNAB is extremely important because essentially of where the business came from and where it started. So let's start walking backwards a little bit. What were some of the major milestones that you hit along the way? Were there specific software releases that you had that were extremely beneficial to you or certain things that happened in the market that really took you to the next level? Kind of give us an idea of what sort of major milestones there were.
Yeah, there were some interesting ones along the way, a handful. I mean, our software development, like our releases, which we'll probably dig into a lot with the MVP, but that moving from my original product into our first bona fide software product, that was monumental relatively for us early on. Each new release, we then moved into the Mac platform a couple years later. And as that platform grew in popularity over the years, we rode that. The App Store, you know, the whole mobile thing, we rode that with phones that that sync up with your data and everything. And that's also standard now. But back at the time, it was a big deal. So that wave we rode. We had a funny one where we would sell the software on the Steam gaming platform from Valve. And that
really?
So we didn't even think it would work. But yeah, we were one of a few titles that they let in as kind of a little test to sell non-games. And we did really well in like their flash sales and other things like that. And so that was a significant boost to our revenue back 2 years ago. The gamers, I mean, they buy compulsively. It's a hilarious side story. But I mean, it's funny that you're selling budgeting software and people are impulsively buying it and not considering the purchase. So there was some irony. But yeah, that was a big one. I mean, it got us out in the market quite a bit more. There were a lot of new users. And so that was another big. There are tiny ones all along the way, but those were kind of big highlights.
Right. So when was this business founded? It was back in what, mid-2000s, something like
yeah,
that?
Yeah, I mean, I officially like did the paperwork for it in 2007, so like 3 years later.
Okay.
But the like where I started making money, well, I mean, very, very small amounts of money was end of 04.
Okay. So you basically operated it probably as like either did you even file for a DBA or just run it kind of through?
No way. I didn't even think about that. I wanted to make rent with the money. It was like totally nothing official about it, you know?
Got it. I didn't realize that. I thought you at least had a DBA kind of in the early days.
Yeah, I don't even know if I knew what that was at the time. So yeah.
That's okay. So I guess you filed for the business back in 2007. When was it that you had hired your first employee? Was it after that or before that?
It was after that. I had been working with the guy, Taylor, that originally built our first piece of software. He and I worked together in 06 for the first time. And then middle of 08, I was able to convince him to jump ship from the video game industry and come over and build budget software.
Got it. Okay. So I guess to take a step back a little bit, where was the business financially when you decided to start hiring people?
That one's tough. Every hire is scary, you know, and early on especially. It's not as scary now. But Taylor, he and I originally worked out like a revenue share because I couldn't guarantee a salary. And I remember he took a significant pay cut from what he was making. No benefits. And I could probably back into it, actually. Let's see, the year that he came on, we probably did maybe $500,000 in revenue. That's a pretty good guess.
Okay. So it wasn't as though the business was struggling, but at the same time, when he first came on, you didn't necessarily know how well things were going to go with him on staff.
Yeah.
It was like you were kind of making an educated guess and looking back for your sales and kind of looking forward and doing some projections, but
yeah.
You still weren't quite sure. It was still a risk in your mind.
Yeah. I mean, he took the bigger risk, in my opinion, because he, you know, he left this career and with the cash flow, you know, a dip in cash flow and all that. I'm happy that it paid off for him later on, but it was an educated guess. It still was super scary, which I'm really conservatively wired. So where I feel scared, most people don't feel anything. And I think anyone else would have probably hired quicker than me and would have made it would have been better. I just would drag my feet. So.
Right. Okay. So, well, let's talk about kind of your shift into the business. Where was the business when you finally decided to go full time on it?
I was working as an accountant. I got a master's degree in accounting and I was working down in Dallas for a big accounting firm, working 80 hours a week for months and months. And it was getting old. I had two little boys and a wife in this new city, and it was rough. So I had big personal incentive to not do accounting. And also, it's really boring work. But to highlight how crazy conservative I was making about twice in profit from YNAB what I was making at my day job. And I was working on it maybe an hour a day if I could squeeze it in. So it took me so long to jump. But the business finally, when I was at about, I think, 15 grand in profit per month, that was where I felt comfortable, where I said, okay, I can start working on this more as a full-time endeavor.
Got it. So the business was hitting that $15,000 a month, which is ballpark $180,000 a year. And that's when you felt comfortable kind of leaving your full-time position and coming over and doing
this
full-time.
Yeah. And I still actually did other stuff on the side because I didn't want to raid the coffers of YNAB. So that 15 grand in profit, you can look at it and, you know, you can eat it and feed your kids with it, or you can reinvest it back in the business. And I was definitely more inclined to reinvest than to, than to consume it. So I really tried to build up other things on the side as well and try and reinvest that profit as aggressively as possible.
Right. Now, you said at this time your day job was essentially as an accountant and you have a master's degree in, I think you said, finance or accounting.
Yeah.
So you're not a software developer.
No.
What was your first product?
The very first one that we sold and made money with was a spreadsheet that I had originally built it for me and Julie, my wife, when we first got married. And it worked well for us. We were super poor, but the budget seemed to be working well. And then I wanted Julie to be able to stay home and be a stay-at-home mom when our first baby was born. That was a big deal to her. So I was pretty motivated to try and make extra money. And about $350 a month was my target. If I could make that on the side selling this spreadsheet, we'd be good. We could get out of school. We wouldn't have to borrow money for it, that type of thing.
So how much were you selling the spreadsheet for?
I tried at $9.95. So like Big Mac pricing, really. But I tried it at $9.95 and I couldn't get any any traction. For about 2 weeks, I was paying for visits through pay-per-click way back when it was cheap and easy. And no one bought it. You know, I had enough visitors hit the site where you should have seen some purchases just from the law of numbers, right? But no one was buying it. So then I chatted with a friend one day on the bus, and he said, hey, you ought to double your price. People aren't buying it because it's cheap. And so I doubled it to $19.95 and saw my first sale that first day. Of course,
interesting.
I had to refund that sale, but it was still a good thing. So still good.
It's kind of ironic that you double your price and then you immediately had to refund that first sale.
Yeah, but I was at a negotiations class the other day. It was fascinating. This guy's major negotiation work with countries and things. And he was giving us this clinic, and there was one little bit that jumped out that would apply to every single person listening. He said, you never want to bargain with yourself. And when we go to price our own services, we always bargain with ourselves well before we're bargaining or negotiating with someone that's actually going to pay us. So you'll bargain with yourself and just talk yourself down. And when you bargain, it's always about price. It's never about value. So he was trying to get us to say, don't bargain, always negotiate, and then do not bargain with yourself, especially. Mm-hmm. I think that's applicable for anyone just getting started. We're so quick to talk ourselves down to this bare bones price, and it's not helpful at all.
Yeah, that's fantastic advice. And I think it especially applies to software developers who tend to undervalue what other people are willing to pay for their work, especially given their average salaries, to be honest.
Developers are wizards. They're like magic people. How do you place the price on that? You got to think of yourself as a wizard, I think, and then maybe you could price more appropriately. Because from my view, I just see magic happen. And where people that are in the know, you have the curse of knowledge where it's like, well, I can build that. I can do that. That's the worst place to be.
So your first product, it was just this spreadsheet. You were selling it for $20 per download, I guess. Mm-hmm. And you said that at some point you got it to the point where it was making, what, $15,000, which was when you decided to kind of make the leap?
No, by that time, the spreadsheet really capped out at making about $5,000-$6,000 a month.
Okay.
Where I started making about 15 in profit was when we had launched our software about 2 years later. That was the big jump. Yeah.
Got it. So there was this time period during which you were only selling this spreadsheet.
Oh, yeah. About 2 years just selling the spreadsheet.
And how long did it take you to build this spreadsheet?
I mean, you know, when you're building it for yourself, you don't really count that time. But if you were to start from scratch and build it and knew what you wanted and had a clear spec on it, I mean, it took me a couple weeks. Of course, I tried to make it fancy first, and then I pulled way back as it got complex, which is a classic trap we all fall into.
Right.
But yeah, over time, I actually simplified it, stripped things out of it. But it wasn't a huge endeavor. I mean, 2 weeks, that's not long.
Right. And that's something you said you were making, what, $5,000 or $6,000 a month from?
Yeah, toward the end, once my marketing, when I learned how to market, that was the ticket. But I pulled up some stats while we were chatting, like my first full year. So I launched in September of 2004. It didn't really do anything. And then in 2005, I mean, by December of that year, I'd made in profits $2,500, you know, and that was when I was in school as a college kid. So, I mean, I was working a 30-hour job, going to school full time and doing this little business on the side. I wasn't investing tons of time, and I was learning a ton as I went along. So I'm trying to paint this picture that even for someone to get to a grand or two, with the information we have available now, it's totally doable. And the product, you know, it was a spreadsheet. It was crazy.
Right. So you said that you launched the software product in 2006, right?
Yeah, end of 2006, right at the tail end there.
How long did it take to build the software product itself?
It took Taylor, he was the sole developer, it took him 9 months. We just worked over the phone. We didn't beta test it, which is funny. But I mean, you know, I kind of used it a little bit. But yeah, we did not do anything formal. Yeah, 9 months with just a solo developer. And we were basically porting the functionality of the spreadsheet over into a Windows application.
Right. And I think that's the part that I think is really interesting, because you start out with this MVP, which is nothing more than a spreadsheet, mm-hmm. which takes you about 2 weeks. And then you make this leap from, you've got a market, you've got people paying for this spreadsheet, and they're clearly willing to pay for it. There's a demand there that you've
proven
with this spreadsheet. And then you say, okay, let me take that information and I'll kind of predict the future a little bit. If they're willing to pay for this spreadsheet, I bet they would pay for this software product that I could build.
Yeah.
Based on this demand.
Yeah, I mean, I felt confident enough about it that even risk averse as I am, I had been saving money up to that point to put a down payment on a house. Because if you think back in the US, if you think back to like 06, 05, like real estate's going crazy, right? So Julie and I are going to graduate in 06 and we've got this baby, another one on the way. And I'm thinking, oh, we've got to get a house because everyone's buying houses. So I'm saving for this down payment. In the meantime, Taylor comes along and says, hey, I could improve your spreadsheet. And I said, well, no, I'd rather have you build separate software. So he just agrees to like a project rate, and it was a lump sum, you know, milestone payments, pretty standard stuff. And we do that over 9 months. But I was confident enough in the move. I knew that people would pay more for the software, and I knew that the software would also be obviously more attractive to more people. So I could charge more and appeal to a broader market. And I used our down payment money, you know, for the house that we had kind of earmarked for that. I came to Julie and was like, hey, what about this thing instead? You know, I have this stranger down in Texas that wants to build this for us. So she was game. But I felt confident enough because I did. I had market knowledge. And yeah, it was priceless. So I didn't feel like it was risky at all.
So, I mean, that kind of brings up a kind of a separate point. Because you're not a developer, you didn't start by building a piece of software because you, quite frankly, you just didn't have the skill set. Yeah. How do you think that affected the evolution of the product? I mean, because I think most software developers would immediately jump into building a product, but you kind of went in a different way, I think, because you were forced to. How did that impact not just the financials of the business, but how did it impact your approach to the future of the business?
It's been a huge advantage for us that we started with that spreadsheet. When you think about building a piece of software, and it was fairly complex, you know, that we built in 9 months. But because we were riffing on an MVP built on a spreadsheet, it naturally constrained the normal desire we have to add and make more complex. Because it was just like, listen, take this, make it so it can run without Excel. You know, and it was like, okay, that's good. So how should the UI act? Well, let's just have it kind of look a lot like the spreadsheet. Okay, that works well. I mean, Taylor and I both aren't designers and weren't designers back then even more so. So it forced us to just recognize we're going to do still kind of the minimum, but take this obvious next step. Where I feel like a lot of times when you build first with kind of this, you know, green, like open field in front of you, you have a hard time making decisions because you have so many options. Or we just didn't have the advantage. It would be interesting to think how we could, as a budding entrepreneur, as this developer, how you could create artificial restraints for yourself to try and control that.
Right. And I think that's the problem that most of us as developers face, is that we've got this open-ended problem that we're trying to solve. And we say to ourselves, oh, I could do this or I could do that. And oh, it'd be really cool if I added this other thing in over here. And then you end off into the weeds, trying to add some stuff in that ultimately you don't even know whether or not anyone is going to use it or going to care, unless you're doing a lot of heavy upfront customer development. But because you had that MVP already in place and you knew what people were paying for, it was really just a process of replication so that you could then produce incremental improvements on it and increase the price and do lots of other
things. Absolutely. Like, just to give people an example, we launched this software end of 06 that is supposed to compete with Quicken or Microsoft Money at the time. And it's, you know, a check register with a budget laid on top of it, essentially. We didn't even allow you to have multiple accounts in the software that we originally sold for $40. So we would just tell people, oh, just no, every transaction goes in one big register. And we sold it and people bought it and it worked. Like, it really worked. It wasn't like we were selling them something broken, but we could, you know, you didn't import from your bank. We didn't handle reconciling to any accounts. We had like very rudimentary reporting. I mean, it was so bare bones, and it still just gave us that much more knowledge to be able to keep heading down the path. And that's what you want. You don't want to know the end goal. You just want to know that you should stay on the path you're on and be content there. But we try and build a lot of times for the destination, and then, you know, who knows where that ends up.
You mentioned Microsoft Money just a few seconds ago. Didn't they go out of business, or didn't they shut that product down?
They did. Yeah, they shut it down several years ago, actually.
And now Quicken is being spun off. How does it feel to like basically have run them out of business?
Yeah, absolutely. That's hilarious. Hey, I feel really good. I feel like we conquered them. No, Intuit's revenue for consumer non-tax revenue is like $340 million a year. They're a $4.5 billion a year company. There's such a far distance between them and the next guys. It's crazy. So yeah, I don't even know if they've heard of us, but Maybe they have. That would be fun. But right. it is cool to see that we're headed in the same direction that the big guys, because I think they obviously have major market knowledge with all the exposure they have. So
there's a lot of benefit to having hindsight when you've gone through this process. Are there other products that you can think of that in hindsight you could have potentially come out with that were also not software related, or were not directly pieces of software, that either could have done well or had the potential, maybe not quite as much potential as what you ultimately ended up with, or maybe something that could have exceeded it? Are there any things that you can come up with that kind of fit that mold that were non-software?
I mean, they're all kind of related to YNAB and its core business, but we've tested all sorts of different monetization strategies over the years. We've tested partnering with companies that we like Betterment is one that we like. We don't take commission from them anymore, but we still refer them. But we were kind of going like a blogger route for early on, where it was like affiliate relationships. I found that to be fairly distracting from the core. We did some servicing around, like, literally, over the phone type work, coaching with business owners to try and teach them how to manage their cash flow better. And I actually ended up selling that off to my friend Mark, who was running that for us anyway, and he now runs that at Budget Nerd. But for us, it was working. It was just, I felt like we were losing focus. So
it was a distraction.
Yeah, it was a distraction. And I'm very, very susceptible to the new shiny. And so I really have to check myself and make sure I'm focused on just a few very core things, and then, obviously drive that through the whole team.
Now, I think that focus is probably something that all software developers who are kind of starting out and trying to find that product that they want to invest a lot of their time in, maybe it's the next 6 months or maybe the next 10 years. But what sorts of other advice do you have for people who are specifically looking at building software first? Because as we've kind of discussed, you had the spreadsheet first, and that's probably more of a non-traditional MVP. What other shortcuts could people come up with that would kind of help them get to the point where they have a product that people will pay for?
I like the idea of utilities. So if you're thinking software specifically, I'm trying to go that route. I like the idea of looking at a very, very concrete problem where the MVP, where the problem is so small and so specific that, you can't add too many features on top of it. So I know the open source is a great solution for a lot of these, but I think you could not do the open source route potentially and just say, well, what is this utility that does this one thing that people on Stack Overflow are constantly asking about, or that I'm constantly having to do again and again, whatever it may be, and just release something very small, very concrete, one-off, no subscription, only so that you can kind of cut your teeth on the transaction, the marketing. And so the smaller the problem is, the smaller the solution, super niche, the easier it is to market it, which means then you can, it's tough to find the pain when you're trying to sell financial software. It takes a while. It's complex as far as marketing goes. But when you're solving this very, very concrete problem that like a little utility solves, suddenly it's very clear. And what I want to do is get people to a very clear value proposition, the very clear solution, and get them to be able to build it quickly, release it quickly, have a defined market, just to practice that aspect. Once you start making money, the desire to build, it's minimized a little bit, because you realize like, oh, this thing that I was procrastinating, the selling, isn't as hard as I thought it was. But all these developers, you guys don't find it easy to sell, but you find it easy to code. So you procrastinate the selling and just keep coding and coding and coding. That was a long answer, but that's
no, that's okay.
That's like if I were to coach someone along, I'd be like, find a smaller problem. Really, really small, and then see what you can do. Like a little Ruby gem or a little whatever it may be, but just something super small and then go for it.
Well, I think the natural inclination for developers is to look at stuff like that, and because they minimize the value of the particular problem that they're trying to solve, and they say, oh, well, I could whip up something to fix that in a week or a month or something like that, they minimize how valuable that is to a base of people. And I think the other mistake that they make is that because they try to make something that's a little bit more generic or bigger, it makes the marketing, as you said, a little bit more difficult because it's not so well defined. Selling financial software, that's so it's not abstract. It's just there's no concrete pain point that you're solving.
Right.
It's just, oh, it's financial software. Yeah. But like, what specific thing are you doing that somebody might have a particular problem with? And it doesn't allow you to focus in on the marketing.
Yeah. And so that's the truth. I mean, you can do it. Like in our field, like we know a lot about the market and how you talk about money. It's basically around stress. But the idea, if I were a developer releasing some little thing that I said, you know, could supposedly whip out myself for 2 weeks, that's the value proposition right there. You talk to that developer and you say, listen, do you really want to spend 2 weeks doing this? I've done it for you and it'll cost you half an hour's wage, you know? And then suddenly you get some traction. The value proposition is really clear. And then you can start to test the waters. I like the WordPress plugin market. I like it for that reason. Those can also totally metastasize on you. But I like it for that reason that you can do small little solutions and get used to the marketing. So it's not a slam dunk, but I've just had some thinking along those lines lately.
Yeah, I think the other thing that also kind of helps people with is that it helps them by starting small because they don't have to think about creating 30 or 50 pages on their website. They only need to create one that says, hey, this is this exact problem I'm solving. And they tend to get very specific, highly targeted traffic, which somebody else or a competitor would treat as long tail traffic, so they don't care about it. So you'll rank higher for it. And then over time, you gradually increase the size of the product and its capabilities and what it does. And eventually, 10 years down the road, you end up with youneedabudget.com and 30 employees and $4.5 million in revenue.
Yeah, and that's not how I started, right? So you start super small and you don't worry about, oh, how did Jesse do this or that? Because the answers are obvious when you're in the moment. Like, I know where we're going now. I'm hopeful that our decisions are solid, but it feels just as obvious to me now as it did 6, 7, 8 years ago, because, you know, you just deal with what the information you have on hand and you don't try and predict the future. You just try and keep things small and concise and tight. And then when you're deciding, should I start a new product or should I keep going whole hog on this one? I would tell you to not start the new product. But
so something else that you brought up earlier was you were doing marketing for this spreadsheet. And I know that there's a lot of techniques that were probably highly applicable back when you first started this process. Like, for example, you mentioned Google AdWords were much more cost effective at the time.
Yeah.
What other types of things were you doing to market this spreadsheet?
I was trying to get in with, like, you know, blogging was just starting up, and financial blogs were one of the first because people were pretty intrigued by the idea that you're sharing finances online, you know, so that took off. And I would try and get into the blogging space, and it worked to a degree. I tried to recruit affiliates for a while and have people be paid commissions to push YNAB. And I had some that were great, but like 98% of them were horrible and would sell one copy a month. And then they would want the world from you as far as, can you do this? Can you do that? And so it was just kind of a time sink, and we shut down the affiliate thing. The best thing I did marketing-wise was an email course, but it was no comparison. The absolute best thing I did early on was I wrote a 10-day budgeting, I think I called it a boot camp back in the day, and it just taught them my four rules, kind of my method for how you should think about money, and it was a super soft sell, and it, I think, quadrupled. Actually, I have it right here. It doubled our revenue month over month and then doubled it again the next month. It was insane. So it still works too. We still use that as a marketing technique.
Right. And I think that actually illustrates a gap that a lot of people who are kind of getting into this, into entrepreneurship face also, is where the initial expectation is I'll create this product and I'll create a website and then I'll put a buy now link on my site and people will search for it. They come to the site, they click the buy now link or they download a trial and then boom, they're a customer. But it doesn't really work that way. The email course that you put out there, that's basically building trust. It's not just website, click the button, payment. There's this time period in the middle where you have to build some level of trust before they're going
Absolutely.
To give you money.
Yeah. And you've got to recognize that they're not all ready to buy right away. Like, they're in different stages. And the email course does a good job of kind of keeping its arms around them while they're moving through those different stages.
Right. And that's something that in some cases, remarketing helps with that, where you're cooking people and then you're advertising to them later on to help bring them back to your website. But the basic idea there is they're not ready to buy today. They might be tomorrow. They might be 6 weeks from now. Mm-hmm. But you still want to be able to maintain some sort of open line of communication with them to help bring them back when they are ready.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the remarketing didn't exist back then, but it would have been gold. Works worse now. It's the nature of the beast. And in our field with financial software, it's absolutely, people just aren't ready. They're in research mode and things like that. So it's critical that you recognize that they're in different phases. And some markets aren't. Some are like, I need to book a hotel. And if you can capture that, you behave differently. But most, there's a long process. Like, I'm thinking about buying a new car, right? Like, that's how long it's going to take me. And those marketers know that. So you just got to kind of make sure you understand how long, what your cycle is for your buyer, and respect that and keep in contact.
Yeah, all great advice. Are there any parting words of wisdom that you want to leave for the listeners?
Enjoy it while it's, you know, while you're doing it. Like, enjoy the whole process and make yourself uncomfortable. Do things that you are procrastinating. There was a good book called The War of Art. I didn't really like the second half of the book, but the first half, it's about overcoming your resistance to really doing your best work. It's been a book that I've thoroughly enjoyed. So the creative types, and developers are extremely creative. Designers, obviously, extremely creative. That is a book for you. You want to make sure that you're overcoming what the author calls resistance. And I think that's just part of the battle. But enjoy the whole process, you know, just kind of be in the moment with it.
Thanks. So, Jesse, it was great having you on. If people want to learn more of the different things you have to say, if anyone's interested, there is a video from Jesse's talk from last year over on the MicroConf site. So you go to microconf.com and then check out the videos there. His talk from 2014 is there. We'll probably have the 2015 video up there because you were a speaker this past year as well. Where can people find you online, and where can they specifically learn more about You Need a Budget?
So youneedabudget.com if you're interested in the software specifically, or if you just want to look at how we market and things like that. It's good to visit and kind of see what we do there.
I'll second that. It's actually very fantastic the way that you have a lot of information there, and you do a lot of educational stuff around personal finance and helping to draw them in and kind of tell a story to them about, hey, this is what your life could look like if you follow this process.
Yeah, it's I have a good team there. So, but yeah, and then the software is excellent. So there's that as well. If you want to follow me online, I mean, Twitter, I don't tweet a ton, but it's at Jesse Meekum. Yeah, I mean, I'm occasionally will tweet something trite. I go to MicroConf, so if you ever want to meet face-to-face, that's kind of the only conference I regularly attend. But yeah, it's, you know, just hit me up at email if you want to. It's jesse@ynab.com, and I'm happy to chat or give unsolicited advice, so...
Excellent. Well, thanks for coming on.
Yeah, you bet. Thanks, Mike. It was a lot of fun.
If you have a question for us, you can call it into our voicemail number at 1-888-801-9690, or you can email it to us at questions@startupstherestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from We're Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. You can subscribe to us on iTunes by searching for Startups, and visit startupstherestofus.com for full transcript of each episode. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.